Hi, everybody. This is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome to the Abbott Talks podcast. Over the past few years, the world has come to recognize Abbott as a company dedicated to helping people live happier and healthier lives. In this podcast series, we'll talk with the healthcare leaders, the executives, and the engineers who are working every day to develop new technologies to help people live their best lives. I know you'll enjoy this episode of the Abbott Talks podcast. Hi, everyone. This is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome to the Abbott Talks podcast. Our guests today are Jennifer Jones-McMeans and Dr. Brian DeRobertis. Jennifer is the Divisional Vice President of Global Clinical Affairs at Abbott Vascular. And Brian is the Chief Division of Vascular and Endovascular Surgery at New York Presbyterian and the Weill Cornell Medical Center. So we're bringing you both the Abbott perspective and the physician perspective on peripheral arterial disease. I learned a lot in this conversation. I obviously knew it was a serious condition, but I didn't understand the real impact that it has on people. And it's exciting that Abbott got approval of its Esprit BTK system, which is the first and only FDA-approved drug-eluting resorbable scaffold for propping open vessels below the knee. So we're going to learn a lot about the condition. We're going to learn a lot about the clinical trials that went to get that approval and how much work Abbott put into ensuring that they were representative of the patient population. And we're going to learn about how this particular system is implanted in the body. So we covered a lot of ground, and I know you'll enjoy this conversation. Before we begin this interview, I'm excited to bring you a message from our great friends at Freudenberg Medical. I'm speaking with Julia Calvet. She's Director of Business Development for Hemotech and Freudenberg Medical. Julia, welcome to the podcast. Please tell us about Freudenberg Medical.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Freudenberg Medical is a global partner to medical device OEMs for product design, development, and manufacturing. Our portfolio covers from medical components and tubing to drug device solutions and finished devices. All in all, we have 11 locations worldwide, located in all the key medtech clusters and close to 3,000 employees.
And you have two companies in your title. Could you tell us a bit about Hemotech?
Hemotech is based in Germany, and it's a part of Freudenberg Medical for the last 9 years. And this year, we have celebrated our 25th anniversary in business. Hemotech is a leading contract development and manufacturing organization for device drug combination products, specialty coated medical devices and components. We serve a global customer base and have over 100 granted patents. We specialize in solutions such as drug-coated balloons and drug-eluting stents, with a particular expertise in paclitaxel and limus drugs. We also offer solutions for highly lubricious hydrophilic coatings on catheters and other minimally invasive devices. So altogether, we have built extensive experience in applying drugs or functional coatings to minimally invasive devices over the last 25 years.
Well, we'll hear more from Julia Calvet a little later in the podcast. If you'd like to find out more about Freudenberg Medical right now, you can go to its website, freudenbergmedical.com. And Freudenberg is spelled Freudenberg. That's freudenbergmedical.com. Well, Jennifer Jones-McMeans and Brian DeRobertis, welcome to the podcast.
Happy to be here. Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you. It's great being here.
I'm excited to learn about Esprit and about peripheral arterial disease and especially the threats below the knee. This is an area that we hear a lot about, but I don't think I've really featured on a podcast before. So we'll get into all of that in a moment. But first, I'd love to just understand your backgrounds a bit. Jennifer, if you wouldn't mind giving us a quick overview of how you found your way into the medtech industry and to Abbott.
Well, I guess it started all, if we go that far back, I had gotten my doctorate in exercise physiology with an emphasis in disease models such as hypertension. And I did a clinical postdoctoral fellowship at University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center for 3 years in the Division of Hypertension, in which we were doing clinical trials associated with antihypertensive therapies. And, you know, I was able to thankfully get into a really great role at Abbott in their vascular business. The prior company had just been acquired by Abbott, and they were in starting new vascular products like drug-eluting stents. And so that was, you know, gosh, 17 years ago, and the business has really exploded and evolved into expanding on all sorts of vascular therapies, and specifically into the endovascular space, where that brings us today, where we have patients with a very devastating disease, a severe form of peripheral artery disease, and there is a desperate need for new therapeutic options for these patients. So it's been an awesome journey, and I have gotten to actually for the last probably, I don't know, Brian, what, 7 years, work with Dr. DeRobertis and his passion with the treatment of this disease, and I think the therapy we're going to talk about today.
That's great. And Jennifer, was there a champion in your life or a model, role model who sort of steered you toward medicine or healthcare or anything like that, or just a fascination of your own?
Well, I would say this. I mean, so you're asking some really great questions. So my grandfather was a physician, but if you think about it, this when he went to medical school, it was probably the 1930s, and it was a very difficult journey for an African-American man who grew up in Mississippi and was very poor to make his way to become a physician. He ended up hanging a shingle in Des Moines, Iowa. And then my dad was one of the first classes of physician assistants. So, you know, there was that influence where I was always very curious about medicine. I was always asking my dad about his experience in internal medicine. And so I kind of just navigated my way from there.
That's great. Well, it's a great continuation. Brian, how about your path into medicine? What led you to be a physician?
Well, I don't have quite as amazing of a story as Jack. But,
I'm sure it's great.
I'm the first in my family to be a physician. My grandfather actually, growing up in Italy, in Trieste, in northern Italy, he always wanted to be a physician, couldn't afford it at the time, from what I hear from my father and from him back when he's still alive. And he used to tell me stories of going to the operating theater and watching the surgeries that were going on in a way that I guess the public could do back then. we still have some of those operating theaters in Boston, I think. I don't think there's any here in New York where they preserve these almost auditoriums where the surgery would be happening at the center. So there is a little bit of history for me, but more or less, I just sort of gravitated toward the sciences and to medicine. And ultimately, surgery was something that I was attracted to, in part because of the excitement of it and the way in which the field very much changes in a sense that's very tangible. And the rewards of seeing patients flourish are very tangible. Some of the failures are also very, very, very strong and very visible as well. And so it's one of those fields where there's a lot going on, a lot happening. And a lot of that is driven by, especially in vascular surgery in particular, it's driven by our industry partners that put a lot of investment into devising new ways of helping our patients and treating our patients. My background in terms of training, I'm here at New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center. I trained here years back, about 18-19 years ago now almost. Then I spent a number of years back in Los Angeles, where I'm from. Was a faculty member at UCLA for many years before coming back to be the chief of vascular over here. And in vascular surgery, we do both what's called endovascular work, as we'll talk about, and then open surgery. And we've really seen a migration toward endovascular therapies for a lot of our disease states. There's a very clear benefit. Endovascular aneurysm repair, for example, it's a dramatically different operation when you go to a minimally invasive endovascular approach compared to an open surgery. The same is definitely true with lower extremity arterial occlusive disease, or PAD, but the requirement for the minimal invasive procedure to be to be adopted is that it has to be effective. And that's really where lower extremity or leg angiogram, angioplasty type procedures have really been challenged. We have had a number of devices in the last decade, I'd say, for the femoral popliteal circulation, and that's the segment from the groin down to the knee. But the below knee arteries really have not had a lot of big wins, so to speak, in the last decade. And that's where the topic that we're discussing today has really, made its impact. You know, it's the first big win in the space and the first first device that has shown a clear efficacy and allowed our patients to have a different level of care, different options for limb salvage. And that's why one of the reasons why Jen and I have been working together for so long now on this project, which seems funny to say, but we've been down a very long course, and it's been a really rewarding course, largely because we see it coming to patients now finally.
That's great. All right, that's a great way to start. So Jennifer, let's talk a bit about how Abbott is viewing peripheral artery disease, and how long have you been focused on this area in particular? And let's just start talking about the condition itself.
Yeah, well, you know, this is truly a landmark moment for people with a severe form of peripheral artery disease. What Brian was speaking of, chronic limb-threatening ischemia, is really this end-stage disease that people don't know about. I would say, you know, PAD is probably the most prevalent disease that is not well known. People know about heart attacks. They don't know about leg attacks. And I mean, we're looking at about 20 million people in the U.S. are living with this disease. And there's just a lack of awareness and education. So peripheral artery disease, and I'm sure the great Dr. Brian Deergers will get into more details, but just, you know, think about it as, you know, it's the disease of the arteries outside of the heart when they're occluded. And when they get in the leg and especially below the knee, it is truly devastating. And to Brian's point, there have been very limited options. So to have a first of its kind dissolving stent that has a drug on it, the drug releases and helps open up that artery and prevent the arteries from closing, this is landmark, because patients, I think the public doesn't realize that a diagnosis of CLTI is meaning that there's a severe shortening of your life. More than most cancers, you know, that general cancers that we know currently in the public awareness. And so, you know, Abbott has been on this journey. You asked kind of how long we've been doing this. We've been on the resorbable journey for decades, if you think about it. You know, we had resorbable technologies in the coronary space. We have now focused on the endovascular space, where there's a heavy unmet need. And it just creates a great solution for physicians such as Brian, because it allows them, number one, to treat in a way that they weren't able to treat before. A balloon is not going to be sustainable in helping keep that vessel open, which is necessary to help wounds heal, take away the leg pain that the patients may be experiencing. But it actually, when it's resorbing, because it doesn't need, you know, the vessel doesn't need long-term sustained holding up, if you think about it. It also gives physicians such as Dr. DeRobertis options.
So Brian, when you're talking with patients and you give them this diagnosis of CLI or of some blockage down in their lower limbs below their knees, what do you tell them in terms of their outcomes, in terms of the impact on their lives? What does this mean for their general health and lifespan? Because I do think there's a feeling that, oh, it's just below my knee. It's not near my heart. It's nothing I really need to worry about. It may just create some discomfort, but that's really
it. No, that's a great question. And Jen kind of hit on one of the big problems we already are facing or have been facing for a long time with PAD in general, is that, you know, when you have chest pain, there's not many things patients associate with that other than a heart attack. And with leg pain, there are a number of causes of leg pain, a vast number of causes, that some of which are very insignificant or mild or not threatening to the patient's life and longevity or limb status, and others which are actually quite severe. And even in the case of PAD, peripheral arterial disease, there's a spectrum of severity of that. And some patients will have, as John alluded to, pain when they walk from blocked arteries, and that's problematic and can affect their lifestyle, but it's not something that's imminently limb threatening or can affect their longevity necessarily, outside the fact that it's a marker for atherosclerotic disease throughout their body. On the other hand, patients with what we call CLTI or chronic limb threatening ischemia, what that implies is they have such a poor level of perfusion or blood flow down to their foot that they're at risk of losing their limb. And this can be patients that are that simply have pain in their feet on a regular basis when they're generally when they're lying flat or at a resting state. And the other group of patients don't have pain at all, but they develop a wound on their foot or toe, and that wound fails to heal. And this, you can imagine having a blister on your heel after wearing a pair of shoes and noticing it hasn't gone away in a week and not really thinking too much about that. But that, for a person with PAD, that may be a sign that they're moving toward that stage of losing their limb because the blood flow is not adequate to get that wound to heal. That's the first issue. It's a somewhat insidious disease and one that is not particularly recognized and doesn't immediately bring people to the hospital until they have very severe manifestations. And sometimes it's almost too late. It's important also because you can imagine, of course, losing your limb as a result of PAD. It changes everything about your life. You become dependent upon those around you. You really lose your independence and ability to walk to the market, go to the store, take care of yourself, get out of bed even on your own. So it changes the lifestyle of a patient dramatically when they lose their limb. Not only does it lead to limb loss and changing their lifestyle, the mortality rate after an amputation skyrockets. So it has a seemingly almost a direct correlation to mortality and shortening of longevity to lose your limb. Even in patients who don't lose their limb, as Jen mentioned, the life expectancy of a patient diagnosed with CLTI is again worse than many cancers. It's to some degree an end stage of the type of atherosclerotic blocking of arteries that patients develop in their hearts often 10 or 15 years earlier. So our patients on average are much older than the patients that come into a cardiologist's office for heart conditions. And if you think about that patient population, patients in their late 70s, 80s, even 90s, they've lost a lot of their friends and social network. They rely on their family and friends already. So it does not take much to get this patient population pushed over that edge, so to speak, to the point where they kind of, for lack of a better word, lose the will to live, or at least the ability to navigate all the hurdles in life. And so our job of opening up these arteries and providing a procedure that is durable, that will last long enough to heal the wound, is an important one. And it's one that really does require something that works long term. One of the things I will say about just, we haven't broached yet treatment yet, but the different treatments we have for the below knee arteries really up until now have included angioplasty and atherectomy. And atherectomy has not been shown to have any better patency rate. Atherectomy is when you remove plaque from a vessel with a device, angioplasty being blowing up a balloon in an artery. Atherectomy being removing plaque from the artery, balloon being inflating a balloon in the artery to open up the artery. Those don't last very long. In a paper I published a decade and a half ago, we showed that about 30% of patients will still have their tibial artery, their below knee artery, open at 1 year. So extremely low number. And what that means is, if you have a wound that takes 1 year to heal, which some of them do, that patient will have to undergo 3-4 interventions in the course of a year. And so imagine being 84 years old and having to come to the hospital 4 different times in the course of 12 months for a procedure that has a complication risk or mortality risk. And then just the emotional impact that has on you to have repeated procedures. And so that's where something like the Esprit scaffold, by eliminating some of those re-interventions, not only can affect the patient's quality of life, preserve their limb, but it really has a dramatic effect on all aspects of that patient's life and their social network.
All right, let's take a quick break from this conversation to bring back our fantastic sponsor, Freudenberg Medical. Once again, I'm speaking with Julia Calvet. Again, Julia is the Director of Business Development for Hemotech and Freudenberg Medical. Julia, the last 12 months have been an exciting time for the evolution of drug-coated balloons. I think we're calling them DCBs now. Let's talk first about the space in general, about DCBs. Talk a bit about the growth there.
Absolutely. Starting with the evolution of DCB, the past year has seen significant advancements. the approval and launch of a coronary DCB product in the US to address coronary artery disease and in-stent restenosis stands out as major development. This approval provides patients with a new therapy that effectively treats the disease, but also leaves nothing behind. We are also witnessing the emergence of new devices for below-the-knee indications. There's a substantial unmet need for patients in this area, with a Lancet published study indicated that approximately 113 million people worldwide, age 40 or older, suffer from peripheral vascular disease. The focus on developing effective DCB solutions for these patients is crucial, as it can enhance quality of life, save limbs, and ultimately save lives. This is particularly important for the high-risk subgroup suffering from CLTI. Overall, the use of DCBs is expanding across multiple indications, coronary arteries, above the knee, and also below the knee. It's truly an exciting time for this therapy.
And what steps are Freudenberg Medical and Hemotech taking to be able to handle all of this new business? You folks are heavily involved in the DCB industry.
As we consider this market growth, Freudenberg Medical is planning how to best support our customers in the future. To that end, we are making significant investments in anticipation of this growth. We recently announced a $50 million expansion of our drug device business to establish a second facility in Aachen in Germany. This new 130,000 square foot facility will triple our current footprint, and we also planned to add 150 new team members to our existing workforce of 300. We are a trusted partner in this product category, and it is an exciting time for us as we scale up our capacity and capabilities to meet the growing demand from our customers.
What can we tie the heightened interest to across the from the clinical community for this therapy? What are physicians saying?
Well, traditional metallic stents represent several limitations in interventional cardiology, whereas clinically, DCBs have proven better at transferring drugs into vessel walls. And DCBs have also the key advantage that they leave nothing behind. Well, this is the reason why DCBs are increasingly being used, not only for in-stent restenosis, but also for further lesions in coronary and peripheral artery disease, such as de novo, small and large vessels, bifurcations, and others. As the use of DCBs increase, we are also observing that a DCB may be used alone or as part of a blended clinical strategy along with a drug-eluting stent or even other technologies such as atherectomy devices. This clinical picture is reflected in the growth of the market for DCBs, which is north of 15% worldwide. In Europe, DCBs are becoming a workhorse product in the principal hospitals as well as in outpatient clinics and have increasing market penetration for coronary and above-the-knee indications. The below-the-knee market segment remains challenging as there is no clear golden standard yet. There are several ongoing clinical studies showing that DCBs have good patient outcomes in below-the-knee indications, but DCBs are competing with drug-eluting stents, bioresorbable scaffolds, and other new technologies. So in the US and APAC regions, the use of DCBs is being established and at an earlier stage of adoption. I think the drug-coated balloons will remain a hot topic of interest and conversation within the clinical community for some time to come, given all these experiences so far.
And finally, Julia, what are the customer and market needs that you're anticipating for the future? What's on the way?
We've learned a great deal on our journey with DCBs alongside our customers. With a long-standing legacy in this market, we were instrumental in launching the world's first approved DCB device 15 years ago. And we've played a key role in the latest round of DCB launches. For the future, we would like to see better DCB therapies for persisting unmet needs, such as bifurcations, complex calcified lesions, and most of all, for patients suffering from CLTI. And we must always anticipate that new drugs could also enter the market, enabling better tissue uptake and patient outcomes. Reflecting on our journey, I believe our customers value our pioneering vision, continuous innovation, our thirst for better products, and a commitment to enhancing patient outcomes. Our achievements go beyond individual innovations. As a partner, it's essential to have the technology, vertical integration, and know-how to launch and scale products in line with rapid market adoption. At Fernbeck Medical and Hemotech, our approach is centered on providing seamless support throughout the customer's entire journey, from bench to bedside. Looking ahead, we foresee this unique capability in action more than ever. We anticipate a greater diversity of products, new indications, improved patient outcomes, and a continuously expanding customer base. Thank you so much for having me today.
All right, well, that was great. Thanks again, Julia Calvert, for joining us on the podcast. And thanks, of course, to Freudenberg Medical for sponsoring this episode of Abbott Talks. If you'd like more information about Freudenberg Medical, go to its website, freudenbergmedical.com. And Jennifer, I want to learn a little more about Esprit in a moment, but Brian, if I could just two things. How do you access the leg? Is it through a typical cut in the groin? Is that the...
Yeah, good question. So in the earlier years, and even in some cases now, there's still a very important role of surgical bypass, in which we make incisions at the inflow artery in the groin generally, and then at the target artery in the lower leg that we're trying to bypass to. And then we make long incisions to open up and take that vein from the patient out to use that as our conduit for the bypass. So that's a very big operation. And now we've gone to a single needle stick in the groin, a puncture of the artery through a needle, and through that needle we pass a wire. Over that wire we bring in what's called a sheath, and it's basically like a little tube that allows us to introduce all of the devices we need to open up those arteries. So this is a very minimally invasive procedure. When I was at UCLA, I did all of these in an outpatient setting under local anesthesia, so not an ounce of sedation or general anesthesia. It's all done under local anesthesia, just administered to the groin where we go into the artery, and much of the rest of the operation in the leg the patient doesn't feel. So very minimally invasive. Here at Cornell, we typically send patients home the same day, even after coming to the operating room, having these procedures with a little bit of sedation. They'll go home the same day. And that really helps, again, when you talk about quality of life and these elderly patients, home environment and home setting, which is so important for them to remain in. We get them out of the hospital where there's all sorts of other, things that they can sort of encounter and get them back to their home environment. So that's a long answer to say it's a very small puncture site in the groin without any cuts, any incisions, even to the point where it can be done under local anesthesia.
But with the arthrectomy and other procedures, is that the similar approach, or is that a larger incision?
No, it's a similar approach. Sometimes larger sheath sizes, so a little different complication risk, but it's a similar approach.
Right. And second quick question. So the principal challenge, the structural challenge of the vessels are narrow. And they just, the clogging just makes the blood. Is there anything else that's unique about the lower leg that creates this problem? I imagine it's just narrow vessels, or is there more to it?
Yeah, especially in the area below the knee, the big challenge is the size of the vessel. So when we're operating on the femoral popliteal circulation between the groin and the knee, these arteries are about 5 or 6 millimeters in diameter. And there's a number of devices that work well in that diameter range. In the tibial arteries below the knee, these arteries are anywhere from 2 to 3 millimeters. So they're less than half the size typically. And they just have a much, much higher propensity to recoil, which means you stretch them open and they just close back down, or just to spontaneously clot off and thrombose, meaning, develop a sudden blockage that just happens overnight like that. And so those are the two challenges, among some other things that are probably too detailed to talk about, but those are the big challenges to getting, not only getting the artery open, but that artery staying open long term.
Great. All right. So we've set the scene. Now, Jennifer, let's talk about the Esprit coming to the rescue. Talk a bit about Esprit and how it was developed, and we can talk a bit about the trials that you've run it through. But introduce us first to the device.
Yeah, definitely. So Esprit is what we call a drug resorbable eluting scaffold. Okay, so it resorbs. Think about resorbable stitches. They're made of a polymer material that is safe for the body, but it doesn't stay forever. And so Esprit, it's built like a coronary stent. We are the business of coronary drug-eluting stents, one of them being Xience, but has a very similar structure as far as the design. has the same drug, what we call everolimus, which this drug is important. You don't have to remember the name, but what's important about it is that this drug is very good with preventing regrowth of tissue once it's damaged. So you combine a structure that's a polymer that does create a firmness to keeping, you know, helping the artery stay open in the short term, but also a drug that's released, and that drug prevents that what we call restenosis. So when Dr. DeRobertis goes in there and balloons, it damages the artery, but it's supposed to. That's part of the process and the mechanism of action. But what this drug does when it's released from the scaffold, it actually prevents that regrowth and reclosure. And so imagine being able to do that in a very long segment that physicians such as Dr. DeRobertis are able to treat. And so over time, what happens is drug is released. I mean, released within, you know, the first time period of this, of the device being put in. The drug is in the tissues, prevents the retissue growth. The scaffold over a 3-year period, what we call resorbs or goes away. Mm-hmm. But what you end up with is a really nice looking vessel segment. And we'll probably need to hand that to Dr. DeRobertis because he's actually, you know, he sees these patients coming back and back. But we saw it also on the trial level that that segment stays open nicely. And again, that's so important because it's this sustained blood flow that you want to create for the patient to keep, healthy, the tissues healthy, if they're wounds, help those wounds close. And hope with that good perfusion, they don't actually have new wound development as well. So this is really a game changer. So the trial was called Life BTK, and it's still going on. We still have patients in it, but we hit the primary endpoint, which is at 1 year, that allowed us to submit the data to the Food and Drug Administration in order to get the approval. Let me kind of create the landscape, because the challenge with below the knee therapies, the trials have failed in the past. They were continuous failures. And so I think Brian and the other two principal investigators and Abbott knew that, and I would say, you know, Brian, probably you would agree, the community knew that this kind of was the last hope. Like Life BTK had to make it, like had to traverse that hill. And so we had 261 patients. We did what was a 2-to-1 randomization. So we had a spree compared to standard of care, which was plain balloon angioplasty. And we really learned throughout the trial process of how to navigate and what were the appropriate endpoints to measure to really show the treatment effect that a spree could have. Mm-hmm. And so, not to get into too many complexities of kind of what that endpoint is, but that primary endpoint was really to see over a 1-year period, was the vessel staying open? And were we preventing the repeat procedures that Brian talked about? I remember a conversation that Brian and I had probably 5 years ago. And I asked just simply, I said, Brian, what do you want? And he said, I want time. Because it is the emotional burden on these patients from going back and back and trying to keep it open, is extremely strenuous and exhausting. And I think at times it's just, demoralizing where there's an exhaustion in having to receive this care. So the beauty of the trial, what we were able to see is that at 1 year, there was a 31% better outcome of keeping that vessel open and preventing those revascularizations with a spree compared to balloon angioplasty. This is well above, we call this a treatment effect. We expected a good treatment effect, but that treatment effect was well above than we ever had seen before. And so what we were able to see is that, oh, wow, really from 6 months to 1 year where those curves truly separated, we said, wow, a spree stays, you know, that vessel stays open and balloon angioplasty starts falling off. And so this, you know, if we had patients or people in their families listening right now, this, you know, the way I would translate it is that you can receive this procedure and you can have the vessel opened up, and potentially this extends your time by which you're coming back to receive another procedure. And so it's really a nice, if I can say, kind of lifeline to the devastation of this disease.
What were the challenges of recruiting for this trial? It seems like you're dealing with a very vulnerable population. What were your your hopes to in recruiting patients for this, and were you able to meet your objectives?
Yes. So what we know, this disease is burdensome for everyone. Okay. There's that piece. However, we know that certain populations, African-American, Latino, Native American, and even women have high risk with this disease, late diagnosis and poor outcomes. And so we knew as a trial team, and when I say trial team, that's not Abbott, that's Brian and the other PIs. We knew that we had to extend even further to ensure that we were reaching these populations. So we had to take a different pivot in how we ran this trial from of who were the physicians involved. We have some amazing, diverse vascular surgeons, more women vascular surgeons than I think, Brian, that I've seen in a trial, women of color. I think that was like a huge win. And because they were seeing these patients, these diverse patients, which allowed us that actually when we compared our data to CMS metrics for treatment of CLTI, like we were hitting those numbers of for African-Americans coming in quite to par to CMS. For the Latino population, we actually exceeded quite a bit than what CMS metrics, and women, we were right there. We were just a smidge below what the CMS metrics, but so we had to put the extra effort, which I will say extra effort. Maybe I should rephrase that. We put in what we should have put in and what all trials should be putting in to ensure that, and we were intentional to ensure that those populations were included in the trial. So I think this has also been a blueprint of how we should be running our trials. And for Abbott, it is.
Fascinating. Brian, let's talk about what approval means and just sort of building off what Jennifer was just talking about and what you'd said earlier about the time that it would take to continue to go in to get treated again and again. I mean, that really builds into sort of a health equity issue as well, that you need to live in New York City or you need to live near a hospital somewhere. Most Americans don't. They don't live that close to a hospital where they can go in as frequently as you're talking about. So this to me would seem like it really hopefully affords the opportunity that folks can get the care they need for a longer period of time. And hopefully the care is getting to more people than it might have previously. And I know I'm kind of trying to answer my own question. I'll let you say, what does this approval mean for patients, and what sort of patient stories are you drawing?
Yeah, no, those are all great questions. And some of the points that Jen raised are really critically important. I had mentioned the older and more frail patient population, how this disease generally affects them. But the truth is it affects, with the growing rates of diabetes and obesity and the problems we have in our country, it affects younger patients too. I treat patients in their late 30s, early 40s with this disease. The groups that she mentioned, women generally have poorer outcomes with these type of procedures and lower patency rates, meaning their vessels stay open less frequent or less long for a shorter duration. Blacks and Hispanics are known to have higher rates of diabetes and other associated factors that lead to amputation and higher amputation rates. So it's unfortunate that in our previous trials, we've really struggled to include these specific patient populations. We've had more of an urban, affluent, homogeneous patient population to study devices that are really more needed in some of these other populations. So that's one of the places where Abbott really went the extra mile to make sure we included the people we needed to have in this trial, because that is who we're treating on a regular basis. The other thing about the trials that have come along so far that I just want to point out is that we've had things like drug-coated balloons that are angioplasty balloons that try to treat the artery in a way that will help deliver drug and prevent renarrowing. We've had stents with drugs on them. These have all, many trials like this, I won't go into all of them, obviously, but we've had all these failures, you know, and all the other industry colleagues of ours were largely at the point of giving up on this trial. So when we reported these outcomes, it wasn't just Abbott Vascular that was thrilled about the result and us and our patients, us trialists. It was the other companies coming up to us and saying, thank God, you know, someone got this right, you know. And so now we have that to help our patients. And going to specific patients that you asked about, I mean, I can just give you an example of a patient I saw just yesterday. This is a patient I met last December, so a year and 7 months ago now. And he had been treated by one of my partners for his left leg. He had already had an amputation of his right leg. He was walking with a prosthetic. He's fairly young, very active, in his mid-60s. And so very active for someone at that age group walking with a prosthetic leg. And he had had the same type of problems now occur on his left leg. And by the time I met him, we had exhausted all surgical bypass options. We had treated him interventionally several times. And he had really resigned to having another amputation. And a patient at that age who has a bilateral below knee amputations, they just don't do very well, as you can imagine. You know, if you're a, not that anyone wants to go through that, but if you're a 20-year-old soldier who is injured in combat, chances are you'll be able to learn to walk with two prosthetic legs. That's feasible. It's possible. We've seen many amazing stories of those patients. A patient with PAD, that is just not the case. And so, see, that's where he was, and he had resigned to that. And so, you know, I talked to him. I said, let's give this another try. This is what we'll do. We'll make it. We made a treatment plan, and we saved his leg at that time. But I have treated that patient, I don't know how many times now, because once we open him up, he'd get his wounds to heal. His arteries would stay open long enough to do that. They closed down, and then the patient would get a new wound. So he's one of those patients, a certain subset of our patients, they don't just need that wound to heal. They need those arteries to stay open. And when he would shut down a few weeks, months later, he would then come back with a new small ulceration. And it was the start of the same process. And so, and I've told Jen about other young patients I've had like this many times now. And so this patient, I had talked to him about the trial. We did not have FDA approval for this device during this year and a half that I'd been treating him. And I didn't want to say too much about this device because I couldn't promise we'd have good results from the trial, couldn't promise it would have approval by the FDA. And I wasn't sure that his anatomy would necessarily be appropriate for this device. After approval, he was one of the, in the month and a half we've had approval, he's one of the patients who came back with a need for this. And I said, well, you know, we'll see, this may be, we may be able to use this device. He asked me specifically, is it approved yet? I said, yeah, it's approved, but I, you know, we'll see if your anatomy is appropriate for it. There are some constraints, et cetera. And sure enough, we were able to use a number of these scaffolds to reline one of the arteries that I've opened literally a half dozen times or more in the past year and a half. And he's only a month and a half out now, so we'll have to kind of see how he mm-hmm. does. But in other times that I've treated him, within a month, I'd lose the palpable pulse in the foot where you can actually feel the heartbeat in the foot. And two days ago, when I saw him, it was a booming palpable pulse that is as strong as my own. And so I have high hopes for this particular patient and this particular outcome. So those are the kind of stories that we're going to see more and more going forward.
That's great. Great story. Jennifer, we'll let you kind of wrap it up. What's next for Esprit? You said the trial's still ongoing. I don't know how long that's going to go for, but.
Yeah, the patients are still in that, you know, many patients, if you think about it, when we started in the midst of COVID in 2020. So we've got patients that are probably about to reach their third and going into their fourth year, but we have many patients who are reaching just their second year. We're going to be presenting the second year data, which will be very important because, to Brian's point, we need to see the sustained, you know, impact that we believe in with this technology. And so really, it's going to be, you know, part of our work. It's really to surround Esprit, if you think about it. This is, again, one of the most prevalent diseases that people don't know about. So Esprit can't exist if people don't know about it. So we will. So from everything, one from Dr. DeRobertis and his peers, we're going to be talking about this, the disease, an awareness and understanding, and also say, you know, showcasing that Esprit is actually a treatment option, because that's not been the case in the past. I mean, you know, I think there's just a huge gap in awareness, and it's not a gap. And if you think about it, it's not just the public. But it's also, I think, the physician community outside of the interventionalists, mm-hmm. You know, and I'd actually like to have Brian like speak, just give a quick minute on that or a few seconds on that, because there is a gap where we need to ensure that when these patients are actually being seen and potentially diagnosed with peripheral artery disease and referred out, that there's discussion about an understanding of the disease and treatment option. I don't know, Brian, do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, it goes back to what we started with. Our patients don't recognize this as a problem necessarily to begin with, so they come in diagnosed mm-hmm. too late in the game. And then I think there has been a lot of buzz in the vascular community, obviously, about this device, simply because it's such a big win compared to all the other trial failures that we've had below the knee. But I don't think that message, you know, we talk about it a lot in our vascular conferences that we all attend, and especially those of us who are very active in the field. But I think our internists are non-interventional cardiologists, or cardiologists who don't treat leg arteries, and some of the other specialties, you know, family medicine doctors, geriatricians, not all of them are as familiar with some of the new technology, nor do they have to be necessarily involved in all the intricate details of it. But we do certainly want to get the message out that there are evolving therapies. This is just one. Obviously, Esprit is not going to solve all of our problems. We need some more. Some more devices in this space, and as a result of the LIFE-BTK trial, I think many companies have a renewed interest in exploring other technologies, and we're all sort of part of those. But this is just one tool out of many, but it's an important tool, and it's moving the needle forward. And there's still a nihilism, I think, among some physicians that once you have a gangrenous toe and you start going down the path of having a toe amputation and vascular surgery, it's a one-way road toward an amputation. And there are cases like that for sure. I think there were more of those cases in the past. We are seeing amputation rates decrease. But not everyone is aware of some of the progress we've made and some of the progress that companies like Abbott has made in developing great devices for this area.
Great. Well, Jennifer, it sounds like you've got a lot of work to do to keep this moving forward.
Absolutely. And well, happy for it.
Well, this is a fantastic MedTech story. I really appreciate you both taking the time to share it here on the podcast. Thanks for being part of this.
Our pleasure.
Thank you. It was great. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Abbott Talks podcast. Thanks, of course, to Freudenberg Medical for sponsoring this episode, and to our guests, Jennifer Jones McMeans and Dr. Brian D. Robertus. Thanks again to you for joining us. Please do follow our Device Talks podcast network so you don't miss a future episode of Abbott Talks and our other great podcasts. You can also find all of these podcasts on devicetalks.com and YouTube, of course. We're starting to post these on YouTube, where they're being heard by a lot of people. Please also share, if you wouldn't mind, this podcast on social media. And when you do, tag me, tag Device Talks, tag our managing editor, Kayleen Brown, and of course, tag Abbott, and let folks know what you liked about the podcast. And of course, connect with Kayleen Brown and myself on LinkedIn. We'd love to be part of your future med tech discussions. Well, that is it. That is a wrap. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Abbott Talks podcast.